From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. The desert lands east of LA have long been exploited, used for mining, railroad lines, military training, or sanctuaries for rest and relaxation. Think the swimming pools and golf courses of Palm Springs. Well, now the desert has a growing role in the state's renewable energy revolution by providing wide open spaces for solar power generation on a massive scale. And that's created a backlash among some who feel the desert is being sacrificed for those green power goals. Saul Gonzalez is co-host of KQED's The California Report, and he wanted to find out more. So he went to the desert, and here's his story.
On a stretch of desert land called Victory Pass, about an hour's drive east of Palm Springs, I'm watching as construction workers drive row after row of big metal posts into the desert floor. The posts will soon be topped by thousands of solar panels.
Yeah, we are listening to pile driving, which is basically the first step in the erector set of solar.
That's Raisa Lee. She's a project developer for San Francisco-based Clearway Energy. It's a renewable energy company that's building the solar power project on federal land here.
And then on top of that structure will go the panels themselves, all the wiring needed.
And this land has all been prepped and it's ready to go for this kind of work, obviously.
Absolutely, yep.
Lee tells me when construction is finished and this facility is connected to California's energy grid, it'll create enough power for more than 130,000 homes. But to generate all that solar power, you need a whole lot of land.
The project site itself is about 3,000 acres. I think until your boots on the ground, it's hard to digest that scale.
But let me try. At 3,000 acres, this one solar power facility will be about two-thirds the size of Griffith Park. And it's just one example of an accelerating green energy boom in the deserts of California. It's a boom encouraged by the Biden administration, which has streamlined renewable energy development within 11 million acres of federal desert land in seven California counties. Along with wind and geothermal, many of those projects are industrial-scale solar facilities built and operated by companies like Clearway. Why do you have to be here?
Well, the desert is where the sun is the primary answer. There's generally flat land and great solar resource.
That's John Woody, a vice president at Clearway Energy, which builds its solar power projects on both public and private lands in California. I met Woody at the company's Daggett project in San Bernardino County.
We're headed to Zone 5. You'll be able to see the solar panels and what looks like a fairly completed solar project.
When it opens later this year, this will be the largest solar power and battery storage facility in the state, and buyers for energy are already lined up.
We have customers that are buying power from this project all across the state of California, from Northern California to Southern California.
But beyond profiting Clearway, Woody says these huge desert solar projects are needed if California is going to meet its ambitious green power targets.
You know, California needs to add about 6 gigawatts a year of these renewable energy and storage projects to meet their clean energy goals, 90% by 2035 and 100% by 2045. And so we're just doing our small part to help California meet those goals.
Woody says opening up more California desert land to solar development, land controlled by the Federal Bureau of Land Management, is essential.
Well, a large percentage of the available land in the Western United States is BLM land.
And if you want to build something of this scale, like what surrounds us, you, in a sense, in a lot of places, have to be on BLM land because they got the land.
In many jurisdictions, BLM land is really the only option.
But as solar projects in the desert multiply and grow, so does criticism.
Well, I've just always found the desert to be a place of inspiration and renewal. I just continually have my mind blown by the things that live out here. And it's worth something more than just replacing with endless square miles of photovoltaic cells.
That's Chris Clark, who's with the National Parks Conservation Program and the co-host of a podcast series, 90 Miles from Needles, about threats to the desert. Clark says he supports renewable energy, but like many other environmentalists, he worries about desert solar's impact on the habitat of endangered and threatened plant and animal life, like the desert tortoise. As more and more land is fenced off, scraped flat, and recarpeted in solar panels, Clark compares industrial-scale solar to past exploitation of the wilderness, like mining or logging.
The threat to the desert right now is similar to the threats that other places in North America faced in the 19th century, where people were starting to notice what was there and starting to figure out how they could profit off it. And what's happening right now in the California desert with renewable energy development rivals those changes. It is the kind of landscape-level dramatic change that could be a turning point in California's history.
Clark argues that if California wants to go all in on solar, the project should be built on rooftops in coastal cities and suburbs, where most of the power generated will end up anyway, and not hundreds of miles away in the state's deserts.
There are ways to do this without bulldozing old-growth desert with millennia-old plants and endemic populations of rare organisms and endangered and threatened species.
Clearway's John Woody says enormous efforts are being taken by both private companies and the government to protect desert wilderness as solar facilities are built. He also says California's green power goals are so enormous, it's impossible to make an either-or choice between urban rooftop solar versus desert solar.
There's really no silver bullet. You can't do one or the other. You need to sort of do all of the above. It's not a silver bullet, it's silver buckshot.
Meanwhile, more desert land continues to be prepped for the installation of thousands of acres of solar panels, joining solar power facilities that have already been built. Back at Clearway's Victory Pass solar site, project manager John Moon points to distant places in the landscape and all the other solar projects in the area.
So you have Desert Sunlight, Desert Harvest, Maverick 1 and 4 on this side, and then Athos 1 and 2 over here. And then we're building on right here.
And everything you said is a separate solar power facility.
Yes, sir.
As ground is broken on more solar projects, the debate will likely continue over how to balance creating a renewable energy revolution while protecting California's fragile desert lands. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Coming up, a new major at an L.A. community college is helping to give students an education about a more specific Latino culture, more on Central American studies after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. Glad to have you with us. I'm Steve Chitakis. There are nearly 7 million people living in the United States who were born in or who have roots in Central America, many of them here in Greater L.A. Some came fleeing violence and conflict or poverty or seeking better, safer lives for their children. Others to reunite with family or maybe attend school. But the study of that history, Central American history, hasn't always been a focus in California's schools. Well, now there's a new major at East L.A. College that's focused solely on that region. And with me to talk about the new program is Jocelyn Duarte, a professor of Central American Studies at Cal State Northridge and at East L.A. College. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Let's talk about East L.A. College. That institution has offered Chicano studies for many years, right? Which is a really broad umbrella, though. So how is this new major different, and what made you decide to create it?
Los Angeles Community College District is home to 9 campuses. East LA College is one of the largest campuses with the largest Chicano-Chicana Studies department. So it was only natural for Central American Studies to be created out of this department. Historically, the Chicano movement has had solidarity with Central Americans dating back to the 80s. And as we can see, history is marking itself again, just like we did at California State University Northridge, where Central American Studies came out of Chicano Studies. We are following that path, hoping to one day grow and create a department here as well.
When you're talking about Central America, obviously it's El Salvador, Nicaragua, right? Honduras, Panama, places like that, and that have been tumultuous places over the past, say, century. But you're going even further back than that, right? This is a holistic look at that part of the world, that region.
We're not only looking at the 7 countries and the transnational community, the diaspora, but we're also looking back prior to the colonization, right? We're looking at the Mayan culture. We're looking at the Lenca, the Pipil, the indigenous people of Central America. So it's not only about the nations that exist today, but knowing our history is important to see how that connects to what is happening today, not only here in Los Angeles, but also looking at transnationally, how does foreign policy, immigration policy, how do all of these things impact our daily lives as Central Americans?
What does a major look like, when you're talking about Central American studies? What does that look like as far as the academics part of it?
So what we're doing here at the community college level is preparing our students to be able to transfer and be able to obtain a BA in Central American Studies. So we're providing them with the coursework that is going to meet their the articulation agreement for graduation, their graduation requirement for ethnic studies as well, as we know that that's something that also has changed at the CSU level. So that's what we're doing here at East LA College, is preparing students to be able to obtain a BA in Central American Studies.
You are a graduate of that program at CSUN that you mentioned, right? So, because there haven't been a lot of these Central American-focused classes offered, I wonder if it's difficult to find the faculty to teach these courses.
I am a proud graduate of West LA College. I'm a product of public schooling. And when I was ready to transfer over to Cal State Northridge, I realized that there was something called Central American Studies. And I couldn't believe that there was such a program. And I remember crying while I was reading the description of what the program was about. And so I know how important these courses are. And so as somebody who went through the program, I began to understand, as I was forming my own pedagogy, the importance of having these courses not only available at the universities like the Cal States, but also at the importance of having them at the community level. And I saw an avenue of that through East LA College while I was teaching in dual enrollment. So it has been key for us to create that partnership with community organizations like CARESEN, Central American Resource Center, RESCATE, Salvadoran American Leadership and Educational Fund, Clinica Romero, the pillars that have carried our community forward. So I think that, yes, there is not a lot of professors that have that specialty in Central American Studies. And so that is part of what we're doing here, having our students have the tools to be equipped, right, to be able to go on and be the lawyers, the doctors, the community workers, the executive directors, but also the next generation of scholars.
I understand more schools in California are offering these classes, but you're not necessarily sold on those efforts, are you?
Well, I think that, I have been fortunate enough to graduate from the program and have landed here at, East LA College and being able to help be in the environment that gave the institutional support, not only for the creation of the programs, but also the creation of a full-time position. It's very important for there to not only be the creation of a course that we offer like every other semester, or we offer it, yearly, something like that, but rather real institutional support is what we need. And so I think there's a bigger conversation there, right, in terms of how many adjuncts we have, how many part-time professors we have, and who actually has the skill set to be able to teach these courses, because it's a very unique expertise. And so to me, I think that it's more about than changing a name rather than looking at the leadership, like President Roman here at East LA College, who created a full-time position for Central American Studies. And that's the kind of support that we're looking for.
We mentioned that this is the first year for the major. What does enrollment look like?
We have seen an increase of enrollment in our Central American Studies classes, especially the online courses. And I think a lot of that has to do with the demographics. Our students are caretakers, their parents, their working students. And sometimes online classes are a good vehicle for them to be able to complete their degrees and transfer.
Jocelyn Duarte, professor of Central American Studies over at Cal State Northridge and at East LA College. Thank you, professor, for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, just ahead, they may never have heard of Stephen Sondheim, but some students of Pasadena schools are taking to the stage with one of his most memorable musicals. That's ahead on the other side of this. Moving on now with more of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's been a little more than a year since musical theater legend Stephen Sondheim left the world for a grander stage. He perhaps most famously wrote the lyrics to such classics as West Side Story.
Someday, somewhere, we'll find a new way of living.
We'll find a way of forgiving.
He wrote the lyrics and music to Sunday in the Park with George, Sweeney Todd, and so many more. Now the Pasadena Playhouse is devoting their six-month season to a celebration of his work, and it's expected to start with a special collaboration with the Pasadena Unified School District in a production of another of Sondheim's famous musicals, Into the Woods. With us today to talk about the upcoming season and this special partnership is their producing artistic director, Danny Feldman. Danny, welcome.
Hey there. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about how this season of Sondheim came together? How did you decide to include a student production with it, which is a first, right, for the Pasadena Playhouse?
It is a first. Actually, I'll go back a little further than that, but we were planning to do a celebration of the late, great Stephen Sondheim long before his death, actually. We'd been working on it here during the pandemic as a big way to come back, and we always had an idea of how do we make it a community celebration. A lot of our work at the Playhouse here is focused, of course, on some of the greatest artists in the theater on our stage, but we also are very connected in the community. And so with Sondheim in particular, how can we make a celebration for those who've never heard of Stephen Sondheim, as well as those who have loved him deeply and everyone in between? So it was an inevitable choice to start this with our great partnership with the Pasadena Unified School District, all of the high schools in Pasadena, bringing them all together to do a student production of Into the Woods, but I would say an enhanced student production. The students are working with professional theater artists to make a production out of their imaginations. So they are overseeing the scenic design and the costume design, over 200 students coming together with different classes to not only star in the show, but be in the orchestra, make the costumes, design the costumes, help with the lighting, all of the different facets of theater, truly to make it from their imaginations.
How much input do the kids really have, though, all these students? I mean, you're really giving them some authority and some creative license,
aren't
you? They are
in the driver's seat, yes. We believe here that every human being is an artist or has the capacity. And of course, you know, there's the spectrum of art making, but everyone has some ability to do it. So we decided, let's give them the keys to the car. Let's have a group of students who, for instance, are costume students or are in a class that specializes in costume. We had them read the script. We had them work with their teacher and with professional designers and ask them how they would perceive these characters. So what today's high school kids think about a prince and what he would be wearing and how that demonstrates class or prestige or power. And it's all from their imagination. So they dream it up. and then they make it. And they're all coming together, led by a professional director, Fran De Leon. And we're putting it all up in the over 3,000 seat Pasadena Civic Auditorium. And it's the kickoff to our 6-month celebration.
The kids may know West Side Story, right? Because there was the remake by Steven Spielberg or you know, a lot of these musicals. But do they know Stephen Sondheim? Do they actually, you know, do they have an understanding of, you know, what a heavy hitter he was?
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly, some did. I mean, Into the Woods, there was the film on, you know, Disney Plus. Now it's on there, so they were familiar with that. But I think our approach with it is we work very hard here at the Playhouse to take the elitism of theater out of it and just meet everyone where they're at. So for those students, we never came in saying, this is important. Stephen Sondheim's important. What you're doing is important. Because we think that that interrupts the creative process. And so it was really always about, this is a wonderful piece of work that you get to create with your friends and students from other schools. And I think throughout the process, through going through the work and really digging into it, they've fallen in love with Stephen Sondheim. They've understood the complexity and depth and nuance of the work, especially how it compares with other musical theater. And so I've had the pleasure of sort of popping into rehearsals and seeing students' eyes open wider to this and really having finding an immense joy and fun in putting this together.
Where did you find them, these students? I mean, did you just do like a casting call or a cattle call or what? I mean, was it like,
you got
is
it.
That what it was really? That was, it was that easy.
Yeah, we put out just like we do for all of our shows at the Playhouse, we always have an open call that any member of the community, you know, for our season shows here, our main stage shows, you have to be a member of the union. But for this, we took the very same approach, and we went to all of the high schools. We talked to them about it last year before the school year was ending. We not only went to the theater classes, but we went to the school-wide network of just telling all of the students, anyone can audition. And we had auditions in all 5 of the PUSD high schools, and then we picked sort of the best of the best who came together. And then the rest of the kids who didn't get cast, we gave them opportunities in terms of the other aspects of making a play, since acting is just one little aspect of that.
How can you catch this show, by the way, Danny? I mean, you said it's playing a few dates, but some of those dates are just for students, right?
That's correct. So 2 of the performances, we have 3 total because it's a very large theater. So 2 of the performances, we are filling the audiences with students from Pasadena Unified School District. And then there is 1 evening performance, and that performance we at the Playhouse have decided to remove all the barriers for it, so it is completely free to the public. And we're delighted to be able to offer that. So the friends and family members and just anyone in the community who cares about all things Sondheim or all things high school musical theater are welcome to come and cheer on these wonderful young people who are giving so much of themselves for all of us.
And we'll have a link, obviously, to those dates and to the Pasadena Playhouse at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Danny Feldman, Artistic Director over at the Pasadena Playhouse. Danny, thanks for coming on and talking to us today.
Wonderful. We hope to see you not just there for Into the Woods, but for our whole 6-month celebration. Thank you so much.
Going to do it for us today. Next week, a deeper dive on all the rain and how drought has quickly turned into deluge, an e-bike program in Pacoima that may be out of juice, and reuniting Holocaust survivors in OC. They were both on the train so many years ago that rescued kids from the Nazis. All next week on Greater LA. Have a story idea for us? What's on your mind? Let us know at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, too, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Ted Robbins, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Jay Siebold, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordall all helped put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and, of course, the ear. Have a great night.